Yeah. All right. Turn your attention to the screen. Make sure I'm on. Okay. What do these four pictures have in common? They're all goats. That's right. Okay. They're all goats. Now, if you're not a sports fan, you have no idea what I'm talking about right now. So I'll just kind of fill you in on that. The word GOAT is an acronym. It stands for greatest of all time. So, you know, part of the argument is Tom Brady, the greatest quarterback of all time. Man, it's hard to argue against all the Super Bowls that he's been in. Michael Jordan, is he the best of all time? A lot would say yes. Then you have a picture of a goat. And then in the bottom right-hand corner, you have a picture of Muhammad Ali, who was the self-proclaimed, I am the greatest. He just came around and said it, right? Said it all the time. It's a funny story, true story. Muhammad Ali was on an airplane one time, getting ready to take off. Flight attendant comes to him and says, sir, you need to get your seatbelt on. And he looked back at her in Muhammad Ali's way, and he said, Superman don't need no seatbelt. And she looked back at him, and she said, Superman don't need no airplane. Put on your seatbelt. All right? It's a good answer. What a perfect segue. I just read the first line this week of the sermon, the first verse. It's verse 1 in chapter 18. They're having a goat discussion. The disciples come to Jesus, and they say, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? When it comes to heaven, who's the goat? Okay, great question to be asked. And listen, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be the greatest. Give God your best if your motivation's right because you want to serve him. But what the disciples are fighting with here, and they were fighting among themselves. They all wanted to be to the right and left of Jesus. You're going to see it brought up later in a couple of weeks. They're struggling with pride and ambition and selfishness, competition between each other. And as we go into this passage today, I want you to see how it segues from last week's message. Last week, we talked about the difference between little faith and great faith. And the only difference between the two is great faith keeps on believing, keeps on praying, doesn't give up. You know, just no wall won't tear down, just to follow God and trust God. Whereas little faith is you believe, but you give up. And we never want to give up. We always want to be exercising our faith, getting stronger. One of the major points from last week was children suffer when adults don't exercise their faith. When adults have weak faith, kids suffer. When the adults give up on their faith, then the kids suffer. And we don't want to be a part of that. And Jesus is staying with that metaphor today, okay? And this week, he's going to focus a lot more on children. Next week, we're going to focus on children. This key passage is Jesus transferring the kingdom over to the hands of the disciples. They've just got to realize, man, listen, it's about the kids. You got to understand that this is about the kids. So he's going to keep this focus. If you want to be the greatest, here's how you do it. And this is how he explains it. He gives an object lesson. He calls to him a child, and he puts that child in the middle of them. He says, truly I say to you, anytime you see Jesus say, truly I say unto you, what does that mean? You're not going to believe this, but, okay? You're not going to believe this. This is how you become the greatest. Unless you turn. Now, the only reason I need to turn is if I don't need to keep going in the direction I'm going, right? He's telling the disciples here, boys, you're heading in the wrong direction. Even the way you ask this question is wrong. If you want to be in the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, you got to turn from what you're doing now, your selfish pride and ambition. And you've got to become like children. Now, the word here for children, a lot of times people think this means like fourth, fifth, sixth grader. What I was just holding is the Greek word for child here. It's like when Jesus was a baby in the manger, okay? Helpless, this is what he's saying. Helpless, totally dependent on God, realizing you can't do anything on your own. Everybody get that picture? Totally dependent on Jesus. Unless you become like little Benjamin Joseph there, totally dependent on me, you will never, he can't say this any more clearly, unless you realize Jesus is your only way and your only hope for making it to heaven is Christ's forgiveness and Christ alone, you will never enter the kingdom of God. Man, that's preaching. He goes on. He said, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in heaven. You want to be the goat? This is how you do it. You got to humble yourself and recognize your dependence on Jesus. And then while he's still got this little child, he keeps teaching on, now you get that process. If you're going to be leading in the church, if you're going to be good men, this is what it's got to look like. Whoever receives one such child, an infant in my name, receives me. Speaking about Joe and Alyssa Woodrum today, they got a little girl through the foster care system right as soon as she was born. And they've been taking care of her for 9 months. And they're saying, man, we just want to take care of her, love her, and we want to become her parents. And it's in the legal system. That's something you can even be praying for them. I think they're going to be fantastic parents. But this is what I want them to understand as well, is when they bring that little girl home to their house, they're not just bringing that little girl. What Jesus says, you're bringing Jesus into the house. When you have a child, you're bringing Jesus into the house. You receive one of these little children, you're receiving them in my name. But here's the contrast. If you cause one of these little ones to sin, if you cause harm to one of them, one of these little ones who believe in me, to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone tied around his neck and drown in the depths of the sea. You'd be better getting cement galoshes, as they used to say, and cast into the high river. You'd be better off, he would say again another way, you'd be better off if you'd never been born. We cannot hurt children. This is one of the keys. Jesus continues. He said, woe to the world for temptations to sin. For it is necessary that temptations come. Watch this. But woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. What's he communicating here? Of course, there's going to be sins. We're going to make mistakes. But what he's saying is, woe to the one who hurts one of these little kids. If you're the one who causes pain, anguish, physical, emotional, social disruption in a child's life, if you're guilty of that, man, let me tell you what. If you stand before God on Judgment Day, you'd been better off than ever been born. I'll say that again just so you don't misunderstand just how serious the sin against God is when you hurt a defenseless child. I'll just tell you right now, my greatest regrets in life, and this is one of those that I prayed and asked God, forgive me, and I know that he forgives me, but it doesn't change the fact I wish I would have never done it because of the seriousness of this. The greatest regrets in my life have been the one whereby whom I'm the one temptation comes. What do you mean? It's that I got someone else to sin. I call someone else to do it. I don't know about you guys, but I was that guy in high school that never got in trouble. I just got everybody else in trouble. I would say, hey, let's go do this. And then they'd get caught and I'd find a way out of it. I was always a good talker. I'd go to the principal's office. I'd give him some story why it wasn't my fault. It was Joe Bob or whatever. And then Joe Bob comes in there. He's not good on his feet. He gets in trouble. All right. I was the world's expert at getting other people in trouble and me getting off scot-free. And man, I just tell you what, even as a child, things that I look back, kids when I was young, weaker kids than I was, that I would just pick on them. Use words to tear them down. A couple of them I just hit in the mouth because I just didn't like the way they were treating me. And I look back at that, man, just total regret. And even in college, they weren't little kids, but just my peers. Teens I tore down maybe with gossip or laughing when they were taking a drink, thereby encouraging them to get a buzz or high. Now they've got problems in their life. And I look back and I just think, man, what a disaster. Jesus, forgive me. And those are the worst ones. Better off you never be born if you're going to do something that calls other people to sin. Apostle Paul says it this way to the church at Corinth. He said, man, take care of this right, that this right of yours. Listen, there's a lot of things that, as adults, we have freedoms to do. As teenagers, that you've got freedom to do. But if it trips someone else up in their faith, it hurts somebody else, even if you've got the freedom to do it, even if the Bible allows you to do it, but it somehow confuses someone else or hurts them physically, emotionally, or spiritually, that's wrong. And he says, man, be careful that you don't take this freedom of yours, that it does not somehow become a stumbling block to someone weaker than you are. We have choices all the time, and yeah, God will forgive me, but don't hurt, especially kids, in the process. And so how does that relate together? Going back to Matthew 18, verse 8, he says, man, it is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet. Oh, I need to get out of here. He says, if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. Now that sounds, listen, Jesus is not encouraging you to maim yourself. This is a metaphor, okay? It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than two hands, 2 feet and be thrown into the eternal fire. It says again another way. If your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away, okay? Four, and here's why. Because you don't want to enter into hell with two eyes, you better be off being the one-eyed Jack, okay? Now, what do I mean by that? Listen, for most guys, if this is just talking about lust or whatever, we'd all pluck out both of our eyes, right? I remember being a college student at WU, when the sun would come out, 70-degree weather would come out in the spring or whatever, there was a whole lot more that started showing around campus other than the sun. And I just remember walking around going through campus thinking, do I have to pluck out both of my eyes, Lord? So it can be a challenge for this at time, but really there's just a simple metaphor here so that we can understand what Jesus is saying. He's saying, don't play with fire. Put yourself in a position to succeed, not to fail. It's just simple wisdom. Let me say it again another way. Is it a dad, okay? If I find myself getting snappy with my kids because I'm not getting enough sleep, then I need to cut the things out of my life that are making me so busy that I don't have enough time to rest. Therefore, I'll treat my kids better. Everybody see that? Sometimes you just got to cut things out of life that are important to you if they're affecting the things that are the most important to you. Say it again another way. If you ever get so busy with life that you're thinking, man, it's Sunday morning, I just feel like skipping today. I'm sure God would understand me missing on the Lord's Day, skipping services, because we're just so tired or we're busy with other things. No, what Jesus is saying here is cut out those other things if they're wearing you out so much that you can't be in the Lord's house on the Lord's Day. Make things priority. Cut out the things in life that aren't the priorities so you can keep the priorities so that you don't cause others to stumble. As a teenager, man, this is just something I had to learn, okay? As an adult, as you get older, it's not as big as a problem, all right? But I just remember younger, man. I don't want to implicate myself, all right? I'm going to take the fifth. If you tend to get a buzz or high or get into trouble when you're around a certain group of people, then what is Jesus saying here? Don't go around them anymore. Just quit hanging out. I mean, if you can live the lily white life when you're around them and they're not dragging you down and you're a great witness to them, that's one thing. But this is what Jesus is saying. If you're being around a group of people or doing something causes you to sin, either causing someone else to stumble or it causes sin in your own life, Jesus says, cut it off. Get rid of it. Get it out of your life. It's a pretty simple illustration, really. It's like the man who went to the doctor. Have you ever heard this joke before? A guy goes to the doctor. Doc walks in. He says, Doc, it hurts when I do this. To which the doctor says what? Don't do that. Just stop doing that. Then he bills him $125 and sends him home. Okay? And this is the thing, man, I don't need to do that. And so this was a lot of things in our lives. We realize, man, I don't need to do this over here because it's causing pain over here. You get that, church family? Simple illustration. So now, just keeping it in context here, I want you to see, watch what he says next. He says, see that you do not despise one of these little ones. And again, he's holding a little baby there. Man, this is so important. Man, I'm getting ready to get into it a little bit. See that you do not despise these little babies. That's the word here. It's the word for when Jesus, when he was an infant in the manger. He says, what do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one who went astray? Now, before I go any further, I got to ask you a question. How did the shepherd know? Don't miss this. How did the shepherd know that one of the sheep had gone astray? How did he know? You're like, well, I don't know. It's on here. It's just common sense. How did he know he was missing one? What must he have done? Counted. It's important. Somebody had to count. We were at a ball game last night. And it's not that T.J. Atkins doesn't care about his kids. T.J. and Cassidy, they've got 8 kids. It's like that old show, 8 is Enough, right? Back in the 70s or whatever. They've got 8 kids. And they're in the gym, and they want to get a picture of Dave, and the kids are in the picture with Dave, all the grandkids. except for he you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, I'm missing one. And then they had to think, which one are we missing, right? He did a head count. I know a lot of you don't have enough kids, but that's how he has to keep track. Head count, they're all here, right? And so this is important. Here's what I want you to understand. This is so important, okay? When you see Jesus give an example here, the way we keep track of those who are straying is we count. He wasn't counting numbers, he's counting sheep. And listen, you will never, ever hear me talking about numbers. When I said this morning that we had 80 people over there, sometimes people on the outside might say, oh man, all Steve cares about numbers. I'll just tell you right now, in the sight of God, I do not care about numbers, but I do care about souls. Danny Pelfrey is a pilot. And this is one of the things that he was telling me that for pilots, if you call in, there's an emergency, the first question that they ask, Bill Davenport, are you in here this morning? Do you still ask this question? Okay, like what's going on? And then somewhere in the process, they ask the question, how many souls were on board? He works for the federal government, and what they communicate to the pilot is, how many souls were on board? And so when I tell you this morning that 80 people are over in Ashland and worship the service, what I'm communicating to you is not numbers. Not that we pat ourselves on the back, but that 80 souls are on board. Do you hear that, church family? This is what we do. We count so that we realize when someone's straying. As a good shepherd, this is what we must do. We must remind ourselves that every soul matters. It sets the tone for the pilot's conversation to the people on the ground. This is a grave situation here. It matters because souls are on board. I want you to say with me, every soul matters. Say that with me, please. Every soul matters. Once more, please. Every soul matters. And within the context of what Jesus is preaching about here, he's saying specifically the word paidon in Greek, which means it's where we get the word for pederasty, which means your teaching of children, your pedagogy. It means of children. What he's talking about here is every child matters. I want you to say that with me. Every child matters. Every child that's back there today in the nurseries and the kids, all you kids that are in here with us today for communion, you are important to us. You have a soul that's going to last forever, and what we want to do is groom in you, love on you, provide for you, help families like the Johnsons to reach those children so they will be someday those who will reach others for Christ. Every soul matters. You want to be great? Don't forget this. Every soul matters to God. Every soul at CK Elementary, every child in every school in the tri-state area, every child matters to God. Every child we dedicate here, we do it, we take time because every child matters to God. Not only that, what Jesus is communicating here, and we see Mary with John the Baptist and baby Jesus while the baby's still in the womb, every child matters to God, even those that are in the womb. This is something when we sing the song, we're going to sing it again next week, Reckless Love. Before I took a breath, what does it say? You were watching over me. Before I spoke a word, you were involved in my life. And listen, I don't want to get into politics, but we're losing a sense in this country that every soul matters to God. There's something going on here. I'm going to talk more about this at 5 o'clock Bible study tonight, just about the concept of how to communicate to others that every soul matters to God. But I just want you to remember this. When I say this over and over, every child matters to God. I realize we can't reach them all. I know we can't teach them all. But by God, we are going to try, church. Do you hear what I'm saying? We are never going to say we don't have the resources to help those kids. We're going to find more resources. We're going to pray that God will somehow shower his blessing on us that we can reach those who are being left behind. Even if we have 9,999, we want to reach every child for Jesus. Can I get an amen on that? Verse 13. Now, when we find one of these little ones, and they come to Jesus, says, I say to you, God rejoices over it more than the 99 that never went astray. And then sometimes people say, well, man, what's God's will in all this? How do we know what God's will is for reaching kids? Do we need to reach them all? How do we know what God's will is for children in the womb? Here's the answer. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Every child that's in foster care, every child matters. You hear that, church? Every child that's in the third trimester, every child matters. Every child in the second trimester, every child matters. Every child in the first trimester, every child matters. From the time that human life is created, when the DNA sparks and the cells begin to divide, that is nothing less than human life growing at that point. And that child matters. It is not our Heavenly Father's will that even one of these little infants should perish. Every soul matters. We get this when we visit over in Israel. I always take our people. They've got one of these in Washington, D.C. as well. But the main one's in Israel, Jerusalem. It's a place called Yad Vashem. Yad Vashem is Hebrew for a place and a name. And what the world realized at one point is that for the 6 million Jews that were killed in the Holocaust, that because of the mass graves, and a lot of them were just incinerated, they had no grave, they had no place where families could go and visit and honor the dead because every soul matters. And so what they did is they asked the families who lost loved ones to send in pictures of their little children who were killed in the Holocaust or adults. And they took all those pictures and they put them in this memorial in Jerusalem in a beautiful place. You can see on the screen now, if we can bring it back up here, all those pictures representing millions of Jews. And as you walk through this memorial, names are played of the 6 million Jews who lost their lives. All they do is just, when you're walking through, it's just one name after another name after another name. And another name, and another name, and another name. And they have spent tens of millions of dollars on this memorial. Why did they do it? Because why? Every soul matters. Same way, man. If you go to Washington, D.C., you can go to the Vietnam Memorial. We've got friends and families, names, even people that were from this church whose name are on this memorial. You can go and you can find the name of every man and woman who gave their lives fighting in Vietnam. And we spent literally millions of dollars as a government to put all these names on the memorial. Why did we do it? Because every soul matters. Don't miss that. Man, war is a serious thing. And the quicker we can get out of them and do it right, the better. Now, I want to show you this. This is something that bothers me, this statistic. Show it up on the board. If you look at this, this is the U.S. wars ranked by total American deaths. Now, the three numbers that are on here, they're all troubling to me, but the three that are the most troubling to me are the American Civil War, the Revolutionary War, and the War of 1812. Why? Because those numbers are just rounded to an even number. Because when you see 625,000, 25,000 in the Revolutionary War, 20,000 in the War of 1812, when you just see those numbers, that just tells me somebody didn't get counted. Somebody didn't keep track. But at the top of the list, don't miss this, even the people that were losing lives, it happens every day, we miss it unless you know somebody. People are still dying in Afghanistan and Iraq. You do realize that, right? We still have soldiers over there with their lives on the line every single day. Soldiers whose life, everyone, matters. When you look at this list, the one that is at the very top is the American Civil War. And if you add up the Civil War and its casualties, it's actually more than all of the rest of the wars combined. And I want to tell you why that I think that we faced God's judgment during that Civil War era more than any other time of judgment in our nation's history is because, listen, God is not mocked. There will be a reckoning when you don't live within a government where every soul matters equally. We had a time in this country, a dark period of time. We still haven't recovered it. Where we called Africans as we ordered them as 3/5 human. And when a nation looks at maybe someone who's in a weaker state and doesn't protect those who can't protect themselves, listen, God will exercise his judgment against the government, against the people who allow something like that to happen within their own borders. And it was severe and traumatic, and we are still fighting that cause. Still don't treat people with equality. And that being said, when you add up, and I don't belittle these things, when you add up all of the Holocaust victims, every soul that was taken during the Holocaust, every soul that was taken during every American war, these are the United States death. What you see in the small sliver is all the wars combined. But in the red area is how many lives, that is 60, over 60 million lives taken in the womb. I don't think our nation has that perspective. Just how bloody this war on the little ones that Jesus says their angels in heaven always have, the face of my Father. I don't think we know just how bloody this war is. Why? Because it takes place in secret and we don't like to talk about it. And unfortunately for those 60 million children, they, like the people in the Holocaust, they don't have a place and a name. But be not deceived, my friends. God is not mocked. There will be a reckoning. We are losing the war for life right now. And if you think I'm talking about politics, you're missing it. Because what we have here in the United States right now is a nation who's losing its soul. And the evidence that a nation is losing its soul is when a nation forgets that every soul matters. The debate that Virginia Governor Ralph Northam had this past week was whether or not a child with Down syndrome, if they were born, and then it was discovered, why it would just be discovered, why we have to pass a law like we didn't know with sonograms and the technology we have today, like you wouldn't know while they were in the womb. But what they were saying is, if something happened you didn't know and a child is born with a deformity or some kind of problem, or maybe they've got Down syndrome, or, I mean, I don't know where it ends. Yeah, I mean, you do realize right now that if you find out, listen, you do realize right now, if you find out on a sonogram that you don't want the child because it's a girl, that it is legal to abort that child because you don't want a girl, you do realize, right? You know why that's legal? Because they don't even ask the reason why you want to have an abortion. Man, something is wrong with us as a nation when someone can say, the more we find out from science, I mean, how long is it going to be before we see what the IQ ceiling is on a child? How long is it going to be before we see, man, they've got a propensity when they're 50 years old to get cancer? That their DNA somehow shows that maybe their DNA could display itself later in life. That the child might have some kind of ADHD or some kind of other disability. How long is it going to be before parents find out that information, and yet there are no rules on the book where a mother can't say at 18 weeks right now, I don't want to have this child, let's just kill it. We are losing our soul. Just listen to the conversation. We have gone from a conversation where people will openly state and celebrate their disdain for human life. They're not even ashamed of it anymore. They stand up and cheer in legislative halls. Why don't you listen to this conversation the Virginia governor had this week on a radio show.
Exception. There was a very contentious committee hearing yesterday when Fairfax County Delegate Kathy Tran made her case for lifting restrictions on third trimester abortions as well as other restrictions now in place. And she was pressed by a Republican delegate about whether her bill would permit an abortion even as a woman is essentially dilating, ready to give birth. And she answered that it would permit an abortion at that stage of labor. Do you support her measure and explain her answer?
Yeah, and I wasn't there, Julie, and I certainly can't speak for Delegate Tran, but I will tell you, first thing I would say, this is why decisions such as this should be made by providers, physicians, and the mothers and fathers that are involved. There are, when we talk about third trimester abortions, these are done with the consent of obviously the mother, with the consent of the physicians, more than one physician, by the way. And it's done in cases where there may be severe deformities, there may be a fetus that's non-viable. So in this particular example, if a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother. So I think this was really blown out of proportion. But again, we want the government not to be involved in these types of decisions. We want the decision to be made by the mothers and their providers. And this is why, Julie, that legislators, most of whom are men, by the way, shouldn't be telling a woman what she should and shouldn't be doing with her body.
Okay, listen, we're not saying anything. Nobody's saying anything about she should or shouldn't be doing with her body. That baby is laying on the table in this discussion. It's like I bring Benjamin Joseph up here. I mean, if we're just going to decide not to, listen, he says mothers and fathers, listen, I just want you to know, according to this bill, you would have no say-so in the matter. He said mothers and fathers, but in the bill, it's just the mother's decision. Every soul matters. We can disagree on how to address this politically, but listen, my friends, we cannot disagree that every child matters to God. Takeaways for the day. Number one, you want to be great? You got to humble yourself and be like a child. You want to be the GOAT, the greatest of all time? Serve and protect children. Number two, don't start checking out on me here. I got to have you get this. Whether it's in your marriage, your church, or your workplace as adults, whatever you do, don't be a part of anything that brings harm to children. For many, there will be hell to pay. Number three, avoid situations or people or groups that might lead you to sin or cause others to sin. Put yourself in a position to succeed, not fail. Number four, we have to, as a church family, chase after the sheep who are at risk of wandering away, whether it's in a child or an adult. So I want to put this out there. For those of you who are in small groups or in the youth group, what are you doing to help keep track of those who haven't been here in a couple of weeks? What about your Sunday school class? It's not just your teacher's job to give a call. I haven't seen you here. The church as a whole. Listen, I just want you to know, it's not just my job. We have over 1,000 people that attend here at least once a month. There's no way I can do it. We have to shepherd each other together as keeping up with these sheep as they stray. But finally, I want to make sure I get this point across to you, that most of us are guilty of hurting a child. And what Jesus is communicating here is if you've hurt a child, you've got hell to pay. That's really not cheery, cheery, joy, joy. I'm not going to send you out on a bad note. I want to give you some good news, but to understand the good news, it's a lot gooder if you understand how bad just what I'm about to say is. Most of us, as children, hurt other children. And you can't chalk it up to, well, I didn't know any better. Because listen, when you're in fifth grade and you punch a weaker guy in the mouth and you know it, or you're making fun of another kid, or you're a teenager and you're tearing down people with gossip, you're old enough to know better. And you did it anyway. There's a price to be paid. Parents, we've all reacted harshly. Bark at our kids with impatience, hurtful words, mannerisms towards children that just, I just remember with Lucas, man, I could just, sometimes I would raise my voice and you could just see that I was just sucking the soul out of his heart. Just because I was tired. Jesus says that's a serious offense. If I've hurt a child, I deserve hell. That is, unless Jesus enters the scene. You see, there's two conflicting thoughts that are probably in this room right now, and I got to address them both before I close. Two faulty ways of thinking in this world. One is the way of thinking that hurting children is not that big of a sin that deserves hell. You belittle crimes and sin against children, okay? And then on the other side, however, are those who elevate crimes against children so highly that you think someone who looks at child porn, someone who has abused a child, someone who has committed sexual assault against a child, that is so bad they're going to burn in hell forever. That sin is so big that not even Jesus should or could forgive them. That's the two contrasts. Either you think the sin is too small, or you think the sin is so big that when Jesus stands in the middle and he judges the one, that he also forgives the other if they come and ask for forgiveness. Let me say it again another way. No matter where you've been, no matter what you've done, no matter how great you think your sin might be, Jesus is so much of the goat. He is the greatest of all time. His blood is so powerful because of how great and majestic and who he is as the God-man that when he died on the cross, it is sufficient to cover all of the child abuse that has ever happened. It is sufficient to cover all of the crimes of the Holocaust. It's sufficient to cover all of the crimes of war. And if you're struggling with that right now, it's because you have too low a view of how great Jesus' sacrifice was on the cross. Do you hear what I'm saying, church? As evil and wicked and desperate as we are, Jesus is more good and holy and just and powerful enough to forgive you of no matter what sin or your neighbor has committed. Do you get that? Jesus is that awesome. So I don't want to let anyone leave me here today based on, you know, some condemnation of maybe you've had an abortion. And what I'm saying here to you today is even Hitler himself, at the moment, triggering all the evil atrocity he did, at the moment of his death, if he would have called out on the name of the Lord Jesus for forgiveness, he'd be sitting in heaven right now the same as St. Peter. That's how powerful Jesus' forgiveness is because of the power of his blood. Wow. Chew on that for a while.